Welcome to the intersection of technology, cybersecurity, and society. Welcome to ITSB Magazine. You're listening to a new The Changemaking Podcast with Chloe Mestoghi. Each episode will introduce an area of technology that needs work and highlight the changemakers working on it. Join Chloe and guests as they tap into their passion about equity and rights for all. Knowledge is power, now more than ever.
And welcome to another Changemaking Podcast on ITSB Magazine. And I'm your host, Chloe Mestoghi. And today we're going to talk about the hiring situation in cybersecurity. We may use the phrase information security or InfoSec. Just note that's a bigger way of saying security in general, but also to keep in mind that cybersecurity is part of that. And with me today, I have DJ Diamond, who is the founder and CEO of CyberSN and also the founder of SecureDiversity.org. Welcome.
Hi, it's great to be with you.
Love to have you. I just remember the first time I met you, which was at Day of Security back in 2018. And I remember you had this really good talk about, breaking and understanding how cognitive science plays a role when it comes to when you're looking for that perfect role, but also with your own confidence, but also acknowledging the situation that we're in when it comes to the hiring scene. And of course, what comes to my mind is to talk with you and have you on the podcast, which is wonderful. So we can talk a little bit about what is going on right now. And I'm very excited to do this.
Yeah, for sure. It's interesting how things have changed since 2018. So it'd be great to share with you. I know we talk here and there, but man, time flies.
It really does. It really does. Even in the middle of a pandemic, it completely does. So the first question I have for you is what is going on with the marketplace right now in the middle of a pandemic, and how was it like 2 years ago, let's say? What has been kind of the really top differences that you've noticed?
Yeah. Well, every year I say to myself, oh, this is the year that, the marketplace is going to pick up by at least 30%, because still everybody's barely hiring cybersecurity professionals. And I'm 7 years, last week was a 7 year anniversary for CyberSN. And it really wasn't until this year that actually happened. And we started seeing the uptick to about 25-30% more, sort of call-ins to hire professionals when very soon after COVID hit. And that was a direct result of everybody going remote, and the extra stress and pressure that put on cyber professionals merited more headcount. But really what happened this year is a result of SolarWinds hitting at the end of last year and everybody really understanding what that meant to them sometime in Q1 of this year. And then the pipeline breaches, and then the constant ransomware that's going on that is just wreaking havoc. And those now we're up to 100% of the difference of, the need from employers. And instead of the folks hiring a handful of people, it's double, triple, quadruple those amounts overnight. And so all that actually means to us is even more problems, right? Because on average, it takes 3 to 5 years to get, the baseline skill sets that these folks need today versus their ability to nurture and develop these folks. And so I'm talking about InfoSec and anything, that falls under the 10 role categories that we have on our website here. It's not great news, at all, Chloe. It actually keeps me up at night knowing the data that I know of how many people were short and how stressful that is to those that know, like us.
Yeah, it's definitely an interesting situation. I have friends and colleagues that are right now looking to jump ship from one employer to another because they've had that moment where they've been holding on to staying at that company for a while, but now they want to try new things out or try a different position out or find a different employer that provides a little bit more flexibility for them. And I think the one thing that they keep running into is a situation where they feel like they're having to deal with gatekeeping still. And they said that this has something to do with where you see in the job postings that you have to have a certain number of years of experience when the role is more like, like a manager or a director, and they're expecting you to have 10 plus years already. Or they've also noticed that the salary hasn't been, it's still pretty low for the area that they live in. And so they're seeing these kind of situations and they're getting nervous about what does the future look like for them when applying for roles within InfoSec. And I was wondering if you happen to have any experience on that to share or possibly some advice.
Yeah, without a doubt. And this is one thing that you've been on my list to get to share, in our recent release at CyberSN, what we've done, which is taking that job building technology that we mastered years and years ago that creates the job descriptions that you see on our website that have nothing to do about certifications and everything to do about showing the tasks and the projects that the employer needs done and what percentage of your time they believe you're going to spend doing those tasks and projects. And that taxonomy is cybersecurity common language. And so, we saw this when we first started CyberSN, is that we couldn't make matches, job descriptions made no sense, employers were cutting and pasting each other's job descriptions. And so the first thing I did was build this in internal application that was this job building technology, or I could have never survived. Never mind the fact that it's complex, 45 job categories now, and cyber recruiters don't exist, so who speaks cyber, right? So it's a mess. And so we're changing that game. It's not going to take long before, all jobs posted in the US are in our taxonomy, but right now on our website we have all whatever 62,000 jobs that are posted in the US in categories by functional roles. And those that use our taxonomy, you can see the difference between the jobs that are in our taxonomy and the jobs that aren't, but at least they're in your functional role. And I would suggest that if you don't know if you're qualified to apply, because those ones that haven't been changed over to our functional role, using our job technology, it's like really, who knows? Who knows if you're eligible or not? Because you're right. They're cutting and pasting job descriptions that already don't make sense. And that's the breakdown between human resources and the hiring manager. And or don't apply because it shows that they don't know what they're doing. Like, but then maybe there's opportunity and they don't know what they're doing. You know what I mean? Like, I don't tell people to apply or not apply. I just tell people that you don't really know what that one job description means unless it's CyberSN built. But there is a clear distinction in that we have a serious problem with job descriptions otherwise, and it's a joke. I mean, you don't even have to go 2 minutes onto LinkedIn and you see somebody complaining about it for the last 5 years. It's crazy to me that it still continues. So I feel bad for them. Job searching's broken. It's actually a part of the crisis that we have right now with having the shortage, is that job searching's broken. So people that if job searching's broken, that means that people are settling, they're staying employed at organizations where they're not inspired and they're not happy. And that's because of how long finding an opportunity it takes. And that's what I'm disrupting and have been working on, disrupting now. And we are disrupting, and it's super fun to do so. And, until we're done disrupting it for everybody, we're not done. But there's 760,000 professionals that need to be make a profile at CyberSN so that we can solve this, and they don't have a choice. But these job descriptions are a joke. They're just a joke.
Yeah, there was an article a few weeks ago in the BBC about basically how job postings have this male coded versus feminine coded situation happening. And this is also reducing the chances of people wanting to apply for those roles, but also that it's already ingrained that there's this hidden bias that those that are supposed to fill that seat is someone who is going to be more masculine because of the male coded RIN description. I was wondering if you happen to have any further feedback on that situation and what employers can do better in that case.
Yeah, you know, there's a federal mandate in the federal government for what they call blind recruiting, right? So it is that your job descriptions and professional resumes are, you know, are to be agnostic to speaking to a gender. And, you know, whether we all think that's the answer or not the answer, at least it's something that can help get past some level of conscious or unconscious bias, right? I mean, I'd like to think we didn't need to, and yet we know we do. So, you know, on our platform, everybody's profile is the same avatar, and there is no way to tell identity, not even close. And yet it is a full-blown resume. So for instance, I don't need your picture. I don't need your name. I don't need to know your address, which is typically all on a resume. I don't need to even know your phone number to know if you're qualified for my job. I don't need to know what your company name is. I need to know the industry you've been working in. I need to know how long you've been at your jobs. I need to know what tasks and projects you did at your jobs. I need to know what your education background is. And I need to know if you need sponsorship for citizenship in whatever country I'm hiring for. And that is all that one needs to match to a job, literally. And that's what we do. And so, you know, I encourage everybody to, you know, blind recruit, because even if it helps 10% of the time, you know, it's better than not. And yet at some point, people have to meet and talk. And so unconscious and conscious bias didn't just go away as we got more senior up the chain. You know what I mean? So it's not some end all be all either, right?
Yeah, exactly. Now, the other thing that some people are trying to get past is the recruiter. So you always have that recruiter call, and they may ask the question about what is your desired salary? Even in the application itself, when applying, it asks what is your desired salary, and it's a requirement, so people have to fill that out. How should one approach when it comes to desired salary questions, if it's verbal or written? How should they respond if it's a requirement?
Gosh, well, verbal is so different than written. So let's start. There's so much more freedom in verbal, you know? And unfortunately, that's the challenge of the written, right? Is that one doesn't want to pigeonhole themselves on a number when they don't have all the information they need. So when it's written and it's mandatory and you don't have all the information you need to make a decision, that's a toughie. Do you call somebody, talk to somebody? That's what I would do. Because here's the problem. When we're talking about, you know, what desired salary, you can't remove salary from the total compensation conversation. And yet recruiters have to match salaries, and most of them aren't matching total compensation because they're too junior. That's just not their job, so to speak. And yet we're now in this time where total compensation matters. So I think it's really about us as individuals. And that's why we use the tagline, "Pwn your career," is that, you know, in today's day and age, one must really be able to maneuver the job system and speaking and negotiating money and taking career responsibility into their own hands, because unfortunately, that's just not where the business world is at. They're not at a place to be providing that. And then they used to be much better at it, but we're not as good as we used to be. And so So I would say to the person asking the question is say, look, I it's a great question. I know that you have to make a match on a salary as much as everything else. And yet total compensation is super tight. And I don't really know much about that. Can you share more with that with me about total compensation? And that'll help me help you with the salary piece. And so, you know, you learn about the total compensation, everything from, you know, bonuses and benefits to healthcare, you know, like ask all those questions because it makes a difference. And then ask them to give you the salary range that they're working within. And you'll tell them if you think that you should continue spending time or not. You know, and so you have the whole picture. You have the salary band of what they're working with, and then you have the total comp information. And you say to them, because for me, it's the total package. It's not just the salary. I have a lot of different things that I get, as well as, you know, if I don't know about the job yet enough or the career, that's a piece of it too, you know? So in many ways, one's not answering the question as much as they're gathering the information and positioning to make sure that they've heard enough about compensation that it fits their, you know, sort of where they're at without committing to any numbers and saying it is how I would look at doing this. And it's not to play games. It's to really understand the package before you can say what salary would be. And that's hard to do when you're with a recruiter. You haven't interviewed yet, depending on the recruiter, you know, so it's not a one, you know, shoe fits all answer. We all have to really sort of work at this. I can tell you that it's always best to answer a question with a question, you know? So desired salary band are you in, you know? So answer the question and say, that's a good question. You know, it really depends on total compensation. There's a lot of pieces to my compensation. What do you offer besides salary? And then, you know, that's answering a question with a question. I didn't maybe answer it specifically, but I still answered, gave some information, and then asked a question. And that is what interacting with a recruiter needs to be like in general, too.
Yeah, I think a lot of people forget that the interview process isn't just them interviewing you. It's you also interviewing them, which then leads me to my next question, which is, what are some red flags that applicants should keep an eye on?
You know, security professionals are social servants, super strong EQ. They have empathy. They can sniff out when people are not in the game, not really interested, not really committed. And so the number one thing I'd say is trust your gut. Because, you know, the only red flag is that you want to completely, you know, ignore red flags aren't bad unless you're accepting a job and you didn't, you know, investigate a red flag you had. Like, red flag is your gut telling you to investigate, telling you to look more, or telling you this is a bad place, then get out. But really it's allowing your gut to be, it's allowing those that voice sharing information with you to be heard enough to bring it into the conversation and utilize that to create what you want with an employer, you know, because a red flag is telling you, huh, I may not like that answer or that I'm not sure about that answer. And so really what that means is your gut's telling you, you need more information, and really allow yourself to have the confidence and, you know, use your guts to ask those questions. And one will really then be able to feel like they're making good decisions.
Yeah, that's definitely great advice on that. What about the piece where they try to get you to do work for them? So sometimes in job interviews, they're like, we want you to do a presentation for us.
Yeah.
In this hypothetical situation, or they'll be like, I want you to do a research report for me about how we should look at this situation. And the thing is, though, is sometimes we've heard these horror stories of applicants where they put so much energy and time into these pieces of work and they hand it in. And then they're like, oh, we're not hiring anyone. And then they take that work and they use it themselves. And so this is kind of like a fear that some people have when they're being requested to do certain sort of work. And I was wondering, what is your take on that at this time? Should employers still continue to do this? If so, what are some restrictions they should look at? And how does an applicant know whether or not this company is trying to use them versus employ them?
Yeah. Yeah. You see this more in sales and marketing roles, right? Like less in InfoSec and, you know, the traditional roles, they are more testing, right? Those offense, defense roles or research, they're usually more tests. But in sales and marketing, you see more of these presentations of solving. Although at the CISO level, I have heard a little bit of the, you know, build out a plan for us, but luckily I haven't seen much of it there. Here's the deal. Luckily we don't see it a lot. It's not a high volume. I would say if somebody has to invest more than a couple hours on a presentation, then it's just not acceptable to ask somebody. You know, it's a lot between all the interviews plus the presentation. It's just, it starts to get to be like, what are we doing here? Do you know what you're looking for? Because whether they use what you put together or not, where it's a problem, that beyond that being a problem is the time that takes from people, you know, and their lives and the stress that it can cause. So I just think that it's sort of ridiculous to ask anybody to take a test or, you know, create a presentation that is longer than a couple hours investment. And we don't see anybody doing that, luckily, at scale at all. Thank goodness.
Yeah, it's definitely, you hear these horror stories that aren't common, but they have happened, and it can be very disheartening to hear.
Yeah.
So what are some ways that employers can do better when it comes to how they interview applicants? Because some of my listeners also are recruiters or also managers of other people in their company. So what are some guidelines that they should run by? What are some ways that they can do better when it comes to that?
Yeah. Well, as we mentioned, you got to know your job. You really got to be able to tell people what they're going to be doing, like be able to picture the day. That's why that job description that's broken down the way that I described really matters. So that brings a real nice baseline conversation. And then you got to be really prepared with what's your career story for this role? You know, what is it? Even if it's, I don't know, past 2 years, but I know what the first 2 years are going to be, you know, like whatever it is, you have to be willing to be in the career conversation. You have to be willing to really make sure that this person understands that you're willing to invest in them. You need to be able to sell your culture as a place that cares about humans. We are experiencing the highest levels of burnout in our industry ever. We are feeling it from everybody, the top all the way down. And things have gotten worse in terms of workload in this community. And so you want to attract somebody to leave a place where the most likely that's one of the reasons why they're leaving. I mean, you think about why would anybody leave their job? I mean, there's very few reasons. They don't have a career path. They're working somewhere that's working them around the clock like a dog, or they're super underpaid and they just realize that. Like, that's it. And the third one is very rare. that's what starts the job search. It's not the money. And so if you're going to hire, and that's where the majority of people are thinking about, you better start there or you're going to lose their attention, right? Because the other people or others will start there, and that's your competition. That's my advice. Don't mess that up, you know, and then move fast. This ridiculous panel interviews, six people in a panel, dude. I just said to my managing directors the other day, what in the world are these things I see coming through here? Get this stuff fixed. That is not good for anybody. And if by chance a client doesn't want to change it, well, you better have that block, that panel, that group of people that are panel interviews blocked off every week. At this, you know, for panel interviews. Otherwise, you know how long it takes to set up six people to be available at the same hour in our businesses? It's a joke. It takes 4 weeks, you know, to find the week. So forget about it. You're going to lose those candidates. And they do, which is why it brought to my attention. I saw it a couple of times, like, what? No. Yeah, no, you know, that's just not smart, because it's all about speed, right? Jeez Louise, you know, those who move win, those who, you know, come with career and kindness and love and just a great experience talking to them, that's who wins.
Exactly. Also, the other thing is when companies don't follow up with applicants. So say, for example, they go through multiple interviews, but yet they never hear back from them. Mm-hmm. And it's okay. Just because they're still waiting to see who else is better out there. And then, you know, it's one of those things that it is common still. And it's definitely a huge problem when it comes to respecting applicants that are, you know, applying, because it takes them a lot of work to prep and get ready for it, of course. So my next question for you is that also employers are notoriously known for looking at people's social media and seeing what they post. Do you have any advice for applicants at this time on what is an okay thing, what is not an okay thing when it comes to social media posting, when it comes to their career?
Yeah, what a fascinating thing, huh? Like we so much room to be judged. Right. And I think that's the thing that we all have to answer for ourselves. You know, there's conversations that we're willing to be in that make, you know, that potentially could allow us to not get hired at an organization. And we have to be okay with that. And if we're not okay with that, then don't be in those conversations, you know, you know, it's a choice, right? People are judging. That's what humans do. Hiring. That's one of the reasons why it's like the worst use of humans' unconscious brains is that they're just judging, right? And so when you're hiring and judging, well, not a lot of people get through the judge category. It's like we got 2 hours to decide if we want to spend the rest of our lives with this person. You know, is how people, you know, look at hiring. It's fascinating without knowing that's how they're looking at it. So, you know, it's know that you're being judged, be willing to be judged on what you put out there. And for me, that's how I move with my life, which is if somebody doesn't like it, I'm okay with that. I'm okay with whatever impact that has on me because I believe in what I'm putting out there and it works for me. And if anybody's on the line or not sure, maybe it's, you know, those are the things to just be careful about, like what you're putting out there, you're going to be judged on. Be confident about what you're putting out there. That's all.
Yeah, definitely on that. Cause you never, I feel like, you know, right now the US is pretty split politically. So of course that also impacts our personal lives and our work life. And then definitely I've heard stories of colleagues, basically they'll like post something about Black Lives Matter. And then within the next day they get a phone call saying they're not moving forward with the person. And they're wondering if it was from that one post. And it's definitely one of those things where the separation of who you are outside of work and who you are in work and trying to find that balance, but also for people to recognize that there needs to be a balance and that you have to separate the two parts.
Yeah. And you know who, you know, I shouldn't say who, I would never want to work for a company that thought it was bad that I posted about Black Lives Matter. And therefore I'll post as I did and as I do and as I will always do. And that people just have to make that personal choice. I actually think there's some free, you know, like free work we get here. It's like, oh, good. I didn't get hired somewhere that I wouldn't have liked. Right. And then I'd be job searching again. And then I have to say, why am I job searching? And then I have to be in that conversation. I mean, I'd be happy that if I got eliminated because of that, because then I didn't waste my time with a culture that wasn't going to be a good fit for me. But that's, you know, only each individual can make that choice of what that is that they're willing and wanting to have screened, you know? So, you know what I mean?
Exactly. Which now leads me to my next question. I know a lot of companies have been trying to push for DEI to happen in the workplace, and that includes hiring more diverse persons to join their office. But yet it still seems like things are just moving very, very slow when it comes to having more diverse workforce. And we especially see this when it comes into the higher positions, where we don't really see too much of diversity, and hence why we're seeing a lot more states creating legislation and enforcing laws that you have to have a certain percentage of folks that are underrepresented now on your board by the end of this year. And I think that's probably a good step forward to have that trickle down effect for the rest of your workforce to get more diverse. But what are some best practices that companies can do to increase the number of diverse applicants, but also making it a welcoming and belonging workplace for diverse workers in their workforce?
Yeah. This is such an important conversation, and it really is a conversation. It's this really complex framework that we all have to pay attention to and implement every day. And that's, you know, everybody wants diversity because thank goodness we're having government push down regulations. Otherwise, none of this would happen. I'd love to see more, but we take what we get and we run with it. And what ends up happening is everybody wants diversity, right? And there are plenty of good actors who want diversity, because why wouldn't they want diversity? And yet in either scenario, what does diversity even mean is the problem, that people don't recognize that it's a inclusion mindset. And part of that is hiring diverse people, but a larger part of that is having a culture that retains and develops people in general. Because if you don't have a loving, training, career supporting culture for, you know, the average non-diverse person, putting a diverse professional into that environment is doesn't give them any of the support that they're going to need. It's, you know, and so my point is, like, you know, everybody wants to do this, and yet we're struggling with retention everywhere. And so if everybody's moving jobs as often as they are in cybersecurity, not for money, and that is a true statement, but for job, you know, support, job, you know, advancement, job investment, or just plain old culture being kind and supportive, that's why they move. And I know I see it at scale every day in my organization. Then that's where people, you know, got to fix the problem, because we've already been putting the channels in to, you know, train and develop more diverse professionals, and that's going to continue. And again, it's not going to continue at scale unless we lower the barrier of financial, you know, entry, and that's a whole nother conversation, which is why I say this is a framework here. The reality is, you know, we're having trouble sticking together in these cultures, and it's frightening. So diverse professionals are going to have it even worse trying to fit into a culture that's got constant chaos and not a lot of support. And so I encourage everybody to really look at how do they have an inclusive environment? Do they have career succession planning? And work on that as much as working on hiring diverse professionals, which requires its own investment in, you know, getting to that population when there's very few of them. How do you get to them? How do you attract them? It's not by saying, oh, we want you because you're a woman. You know, like we're all sick of that. And so it's those two things, because every woman that's got some experience is now looking to see what's the culture, what's going on. Is it inclusive? Am I going to be able to be successful here? Am I going to be able to get past middle management, which is where, you know, we're kind of getting stuck. And so it's really those two things together.
That's a really good overview of it. I always recommend to people that, you know, before you apply, message someone that you know that works there and ask, what is the workplace culture like before applying? Because it saves you time when you find out from someone close. It's like, oh, it's micromanaging. It's toxic. Like, I feel like I'm the only one here with my background. But then you get a lot of folks that speak really highly of their companies. And those are the ones that you want to really chase after. So I have to ask the last question. And I know that this question means a lot to some of the listeners, so I don't want to skip over it, which is, what are some ways that people do better on their resume? And what are some no-nos when it comes to their resume? Like, what should they put on there? What should they leave off of there? And what things need to be included more so?
Well, I'd say if you're not in a C-level seat, definitely not more than 2 pages. If you are in a C, not more than 3. I would also say that, if you're newer into security or even not newer, but you're out there in GitHub or you're doing CTFs, those types of, you know, getting into the community projects up, I would be putting that up front, you know, more of a, in the summary than anywhere else. So front and center. And be as specific as possible, which is why you could actually build your profile at CyberSN and then you can export it and utilize it for your resume wherever you want to send it, is those tasks and those projects. Be very specific, because it's easier for a hiring manager who, believe it or not, even though there's these recruiter gatekeepers, the most hiring managers have realized they don't want their recruiters doing the, you know, the screening of the resumes, if you will. So they'll screen the resumes, then give them back over to the recruiter, to the ones they want them to call, because the recruiter can't screen the resumes. And then they give them a list of things to cover when they call, you know, like money and location or this and that with the job. And so, you know, your resume might potentially get to a hiring manager before your recruiter ever called you. That's very, very possible. So you're really writing your resume for somebody that's in the industry, not writing it for SEO. And so those tasks and those projects for people to be hiring managers to be able to see what you've been doing, they can easily assimilate to work they need done, and they can just, it just works much better. And then, it's always helpful to have your education, but really the only no-nos are getting, you know, a personal cover letter is to every job you apply to is not a good use of time. Cover letters in general, people don't read anymore. So I wouldn't say it's a no-no. It's just not a good use of time, you know?
Yeah, exactly. I did have someone ask that question about a year ago, saying, you know, it does have a section on there about my cover letter. Should I make it, you know, just for them? What should I do? It's one of those things where I know that when I was looking at job applications, I mean, when I was hiring folks, I would always look at, I would kind of skim the cover letter to get a sense of the person, but the reality, most of it was on their resume at the end of the day.
Yeah. And what's more important is the follow-up thank yous anybody you speak to. It's really important. We all love that, you know, meaningful follow-up that, you know, from a conversation. So I'd put my time there than custom cover letters, because you're closer to the in the target, you know? You're in the game, if you will.
Exactly. Exactly on that one. I love when I would receive emails saying thank you for taking the time, and you know, they may ask a question, they may not. And either one, for me, it just shows, you know, okay, this is good. I like this. Because it's kind of like an old school thing, but I still love it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, unfortunately, the ATS systems just, you know, it's just there because it's, you know, it's a feature, not because anybody's using it. If we were back in the fax system of when I started in this business in the early 90s, then we all read those cover letters, you know. But today they're going into ATSs and it's nobody's reading it.
Yep, exactly. Yep. Well, thank you so much for being on the podcast. And if anyone has any further questions, you know, feel free to reach out to her. She's always taking DMs. And also there are some links in the bottom just for everyone if you want to learn a little bit more of either one of her ventures. And I hope everyone is staying well and safe. And thank you again, DJ, for being on here.
It was great to be with you. Thanks for the great questions.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of the Changemaking Podcast with Chloe Mestaghi. If you learned something new and this podcast made you think, then share ITSPmagazine.com with your friends, family, and colleagues. If you represent a company and wish to associate your brand with our conversations, sponsor one or more of our podcast channels. We hope you will come back for more stories and follow us on our journey. You can always find us at the intersection of technology, cybersecurity, and society.